Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Josh Koppelman. Josh is the founder of First Round Capital, one of the best seed funds today. We talk about his come-up story, how he started Half.com, sold it to eBay, how he started First Round, how he learned how to invest, advice to entrepreneurs, and much more. For anyone looking to learn how to invest, Josh is one of the best in the game today and drops a ton of knowledge in this episode. All right, here's Josh. First things first, Josh, welcome to the Product Hunt podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
Are you calling from Philadelphia right now?
I am. I'm in Philly today.
Yeah. So first things first, when you talk to someone at a dinner party who's not familiar with First Round and they ask, hey, what's First Round? What do you tell them?
I say we're a seed stage venture capital fund. We invest at the earliest stages when an entrepreneur pretty much just has an idea.
And I'm curious, we're going to delve really deep into First Round, but let's go back in time. How did you come up with the name First Round and why First Round?
Well, when we started First Round, I'd helped to found or founded three other companies, and I'd been making angel investments for several years on my own, and realized that the time and the stage that I really liked investing was the very beginning. I think there's something magical about a company's first 18 to 24 months. So many important things get baked: the DNA, the culture, the first 20 hires, your go-to-market, your hunt for product market fit. All of that happens up front. And that's the part of company creation that I really enjoy the most. So when it came to sort of create a venture fund and name the venture fund, we aspired to name it to something that made it very unambiguous as to where and when we like to invest. And that is often in the first institutional round of funding.
And would you say, if you were starting a venture fund today, would you say this, there were like 300 seed funds started last year. Has the space become way too saturated?
Well, I think the space has clearly become far more competitive. On the one hand, that's a great thing for entrepreneurs in that, the ability to get access to that riskiest tranche of capital. It's never easy for an entrepreneur to raise capital, but I'd also say it's never been easier for an entrepreneur to raise seed stage capital. Let's put it this way. We own the domain name secondround.com, but we have no plans to use it right now.
That's good to know. Just flexing, just in case. we'll get more into First Round, but to go even further back, when you were, you obviously started Half.com, but when you were in high school and college, did you know that you wanted to be an entrepreneur or investor? What did you think you wanted to do?
So I was always fascinated with entrepreneurship. Like, I was the kid who got a VHS video camera and then started, charging people to tape birthday parties, anniversaries, weddings, and bar mitzvahs. I was I was always looking for ways to solve problems for people and obviously make some money doing it. So when I went to college, I went to Wharton undergrad, and I majored in entrepreneurial management. It was always a focus for me. I think I'm lucky because my grandfather was an entrepreneur.
What did he do?
He founded, after World War II, he got into college on the GI Bill and then founded a company called General Transistor, which was one of the first transistor companies, which then merged into General Instrument.
And I feel like you got into entrepreneurship, in the like 90s before it was, way before the social network, like before it was cool.
Yeah, it was a different world back then, right? I got into entrepreneurship really almost before the internet. I co-founded my first company 2 years before the web browser was invented. And so those are the days when it was really mainly about packaged software and you were dealing with shelf space and distribution. When you look just in my own short career, when I look at the transition and the transformation that the industry's gone through, It's incredible. The entrepreneurs today have such an advantage over even the entrepreneurs at 10, 15 years ago. In my first company, we had to raise $5 million to get to first product ship. We had to buy expensive tandem hardware. We had to build our own data center because there was no concept of a co-located data center. You know, the second company, it took $2.5 million to get to first product ship. That was Half.com. And the third company I helped found, Turntide, just raised $750,000 before first product ships. So, you know, and today at first run, we're seeing companies that could ship products on $50,000 of total investment. So I've lived through the democratization of entrepreneurship.
Wow. And tell me, when you sold Half.com to eBay, was that the first sale that really impacted, you know, significantly impacted your life, or was there one before that?
There was one before that. My first company that I was a co-founder of was a company called Infonautics, which we started in 91, and we were fortunate enough to go public on NASDAQ in 96.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of people listening are aspiring entrepreneurs, you know, already have companies, various stages. Take us back to 96 and just tell me what it was like for you to sell a company and now, like, just be in a totally different state of life financially. You know, what did that mean for you? Just take me back there. Tell us the story.
Sure. So I think that I'm a believer that great economics are often a consequence of building a great company, but they're not necessarily the goal. So for me, that, you know, I would actually argue that the single best moment of one of the best moments in my professional career was when eBay bought Half.com in 2000. And we had the all-employee meeting to tell the team that we were just acquired. And, you know, we handed each employee in an envelope telling them what their stock in Half.com would be worth. And the process of handing those envelopes out actually was far more satisfying to me than any personal economic outcome, just because it made tangible the impact that an exit might have on the entire team and their lives and their kids' lives and their futures. It was a really special moment.
Yeah, and so let's go to that moment for a second. So you had just, you know, had your second exit. Did you know that you wanted to become an investor after that, or did you, you know, have any grand ambitions for what you wanted to do?
So I'd been angel investing, and I continued angel investing for 4 years after that. I probably did about 40 to 50 angel investments before we started First Round Capital. So I knew that I really enjoyed angel investing. I knew that as an investor, being around at the earliest stages is really special, because you're starting with a blank etch-a-sketch. You're starting with no footprints in the snow. And coming in and working with entrepreneurs through that was what I really enjoyed. And so I didn't aspire to become a venture capitalist, nor did I say my goal was to start a venture firm. I kind of backed into it and sort of created First Round as an afterthought, after sort of realizing that what I was enjoying as an individual from an angel investor, I could do at a greater level and scale it more as an institutional investor.
And when you were angel investing before, you know, it was common to angel invest.
I guess so. I was angel investing from 99 to 2004, and then we started First Round at the end of 2004.
And when you say, you know, scale what you were doing, did you have the services model in mind? Because I think you get, you know, First Round gets a lot of credit in you for kind of inventing that model that, you know, Andreessen and others have later adopted.
No, I'd say it was very organic. What we ended up doing was, shortly after we started First Round, we said, well, let's create a, you know, at the time, Yahoo Groups was great group, was probably the best social network out there. So let's create a Yahoo group for our founders. And what we found was that they were sharing they all experienced similar challenges and had similar needs. And so it kind of grew organically from there. I remember Aaron Patzer, the founder of Mint.com. Mint won what was then called TechCrunch 40, which then became TechCrunch Disrupt. They won the conference in terms of the you know, winning the grand prize. And he originally had planned to get 25,000 users by the end of the year. And I think he got 25,000 users by the end of the day after winning the conference. And his... Right. his database just crashed. I think it was MySQL. And he, you know, he called my partner Rob, who was point on that company, and said, "Rob, can you help me scale MySQL?" And we, that was not something we could solve. But we said, why don't we make a few phone calls? And we started calling people. But at the same time we were calling people, he sent an email to the CEO group that we created on Yahoo Groups. And within a few hours, he was connected to Martin Mikos, the founder of MySQL. He was connected to someone at Facebook who had experienced a similar problem. It turned out it was just a variable, like a caching parameter. And he was able to get his site up and running. And the community solved the problem. We didn't. In that it wasn't Rob or I making a phone call. It was the community of other CEOs who were able to connect him to the right resource. And that's when we realized, I think that really sort of crystallized the notion that if you could, instead of being a venture firm managing a portfolio, if you could be a venture firm building a community, it could be far more powerful. There's far more network effects. The impact and reach is greater than relying just on like an individual partner's network to deliver the value. And that was kind of like, I'd say, the genesis.
And let's talk about the community, because the first round community, you know, is legendary in a lot, you know, especially the CEO group, the internal network. That's why a lot of people take, you know, first round money among all the other seed funds out there. And a lot of, you know, venture firms have portfolios, but why do you think the first round community is so strong? What have you guys done that other people haven't necessarily done?
So I'd say a few things. Let me give you an analogy. When, you know, I can't tell you the number of times I see, you know, a consumer app and someone's, you know, and I talk to them about distribution, and then their answer about how they're going to get distribution is, excuse me, is, "Oh, we're just going to make it viral." As if there's like virality dust that you could sprinkle on an app. Like, I guarantee you, like if you were the CEO of a company like Nike that was spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and you had a choice of spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year or pushing the virality button, you would make it viral. But virality is hard, and virality needs to be baked in from the very beginning. Oftentimes, apps have a viral loop to start, and then they build the app on top of that. I'd say community is the same thing. It's not something that you could push a community button or sprinkle community dust on it on a group of strangers and say, this is your new community. It has to grow organically, and it has to be part of the DNA from the very beginning. So I think one of the things that we've been fortunate about is that when people choose first round as an investor, they're not just opting in to take our money, they're opting in to become a part of our community. And there's that ethos from the very beginning. And in fact, that's what attracts a lot of the companies who choose to work with us. And I think that is really important. The second thing is that it's not just lip service. We have 15 people who work on our platform's community and services teams. These are people whose sole job is to help and to work with our founders to help them help each other. So whether it's, you know, having software engineers on staff or recruiters on staff or hosting over 70 in-person events just for our community each year, we invest very heavily, because a community, again, only exists if it's a curated, trusted group and respected group of people. And we've come to realize that that has to happen both online and offline. So I'd say it's been a journey, but we've learned a lot and have really baked it into part of the DNA of First Round and the expectations of both giving and getting in terms of helping other companies is sort of part, it sort of comes with our term sheet.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the beginning again. How did you pick your early partners for First Round?
Sure. So I was fortunate enough to have a co-founder, Howard Morgan. Howard was my first angel investor. He was a professor at Penn, and he was my first angel investor in Infonautics back in 91. So I'd already known Howard for quite some time, and he was far more experienced angel investor than I was. He was angel investing in the late 80s and early 90s. So Howard was my co-founder. And then very quickly, we added two other partners. We added Chris Fralick and Rob Hayes. Chris was my first executive hire at Half.com, my second company. So I'd worked with Chris and known Chris for over a decade before starting First Round. And Rob Hayes, I had served on several boards with when he was a venture capitalist at the Omidyar Group, and thought that we shared a very similar outlook and perspective. So the four of us, you know, within a year of getting First Round started, the four of us were all up and running, and all four, you know, all four of us are still at First Round today, over a decade later.
Wow. And for the first early years, you know, first two or three early years, did you have any huge wins coming right out the gate? Did you have any huge mistakes? How were those first early years?
So what I've come to realize about venture is a very humbling business, because you look at the conversations and the points of view you had with such conviction and such authority, and then you know, the benefit of hindsight, obviously, you, 6 years later, 7 years later, is the companies that you were banging the table for, yes, you regret those, and the companies you were banging the table for no in terms of passing on them, you also have regrets. So, you know, our woulda, coulda, shoulda list is extremely long at First Round. You know, that said, we've been fortunate enough in the early years to work with a number of companies. I'd say that, like, Mint was one of our first validating exits. We led the seed round there, and then just a few years later, that company got acquired by Intuit. AppNexus is a company we funded 3 years in. That continues to grow extremely well. You know, it's a reported unicorn based in New York in the ed tech space. But I think it probably wasn't until Rob led our investment in Uber, where we led the seed round there, that we kind of realized, yeah, I think we're doing okay here.
Yeah, that was a big one. And you just mentioned New York. You know, you've done this from Philadelphia.
Yeah. So I live in Philadelphia, but I would say that, you know, if you look at, we have 35 people at First Round, and over 20 of them are based in our San Francisco office. So I'd really say that the nexus of First Round is West Coast. You know, we have multiple partners on the team. Most of our platform team is there. I live in Philadelphia, and we also have an office in New York and partners in New York. So, you know, our view is that great founders, great companies could be started anywhere. There might be advantages to scaling them in certain ecosystems, but in terms of going from sort of 0 to 20 employees, we believe that great companies can be founded everywhere. And I think part of our DNA of being a geographically distributed firm is recognizing that there are real opportunities to meet with geographically distributed entrepreneurs.
But you've chosen, you know, deliberately to live in Philadelphia. Is that something you've gone back and forth about? You know, how do you make sense of that now?
So I've chosen to live in, you know, the reason I live in Philadelphia is for personal and family reasons. It's you know, the community that my wife and I are very comfortable in, and our kids are very comfortable growing up in. I'm not sure I would have chosen Philadelphia if I had a blank slate saying which is the city that, you know, which city would be the single best city for your career. That said, Philadelphia, like most other, you know, non-core ecosystems, like most cities other than San Francisco and New York, you know, is seeing a burgeoning, you know, growth in startups. But for me, I actually think, you know, I'm on the West Coast one out of every 3 weeks. So I'm out, you know, I'm out West about a third of my time. And what I actually find is there is a real benefit to not being in the Valley sort of echo chamber consistently. The ability to sort of see how the rest of the world views technology and how technology spreads is really compelling. But I'd say Philadelphia for me is more of an accident of geography than anything of intentional or deliberate planning.
When you talk to entrepreneurs who either, you know, just had a success or, you know, are now starting to angel invest and are, you know, curious, dipping their toes in, maybe they'll become a VC at some point, what advice do you give them to become, you know, a strong angel investor?
A few things. The first thing I did as an angel investor was lose all the money I wrote on the first 5 checks.
Sounds familiar.
I think that's pretty common with angel investors. It takes some time to figure it out. So my advice is start off with smaller checks than you ultimately expect to write, and view them as tuition. Obviously, you might get lucky, but view it as tuition because you're going to learn a lot. I think when I talk to people who have made their fifth or their 10th or their 15th investment, they're far smarter and far more savvy and sophisticated. And I'd say maybe far better pickers of entrepreneurs and of companies than they were in the beginning. You know, I think there's two real approaches to angel investing. There's the hobbyist and there's the full-time angel. And I think it's really important to figure out which you're in. And then the third thing is there's always the question that I think good angels ask, which is, why am I seeing this opportunity? You know, there's so much competition out there. There's so much seed stage capital out there that you have to wonder, are you seeing it because other people wouldn't fund it? Or are you seeing it because you have an edge? So if it's a founder that you have a relationship with, if it's a founding team that you know, or if it's an industry that you have prior experience in, well, then maybe you're seeing it because you have an advantage over the other investors. But I'd also say that if it's an industry, you know, a complete stranger as a founder in an industry you don't know, and you're sort of one of the only people around the table, often you have to wonder sort of, am I here because I'm smarter than everyone else, or am I here because I'm dumber than everyone else?
Right. And if you do have a relationship with the founder, but it's a hot round or something, and you're just starting out, and they're only offering you, like, you know, a very small amount, like an uncapped note, do you still do it? Because I remember Dave Morin and Kevin Collin were telling me that's how they started out, just trying to get into the best deals no matter what, just to build up their portfolio.
Yeah, I think there's some value to sort of starting out with you know, getting some strong logos, so to speak. Over time, I think you quickly come to realize that, like, for example, at first one, we don't do uncapped notes. We don't think that they offer an equal spreading of risk. So over time, you'll sort of figure out, okay, am I doing this for a marketing deal, or am I doing this for an economic return?
Right. And when you talk to people who are already venture capitalists and have been doing it for a bit, what are like very common mistakes or even insidious, uncommon mistakes that you see other investors make, whether it's how they treat the entrepreneur or how they, look at the entrepreneur? Like, what's something you find yourself advising against?
So I could talk about some of the mistakes I've made, first off.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's easier for me to talk about the mistakes I made than to throw stones at other people, because I sure have made plenty. Look, so I was an operator. I ran three companies before I became a venture capitalist. And so I viewed my initial meetings with entrepreneurs, I oftentimes wore my operator lenses. So what that means is an entrepreneur would come in and I'd be talking to them, and they'd be telling me about their plan and what they plan to do and their business. And I would instantly deconstruct the plan to sort of the components. So instead of saying, like, instead of viewing it as a package, I would kind of say, oh, wow, this entrepreneur has some great raw ingredients. So, like, to use a metaphor, you know, the entrepreneur would come in and tell me that they wanted to make brownies. And I would say, wow, look, they got chocolate chips, they've got sugar, they've got cream. If I was making something, I could make a kick-ass chocolate souffle with this. And I would underwrite it, and I would kind of invest based on what I would do with those same raw ingredients or components rather than what they wanted to do. So I would imagine it, like, if I was in that entrepreneur's shoes, this is the recipe or this is the plan I would follow, rather than listening for what the entrepreneur wanted to do. And I found that in all of those cases where I did that, I lost my money. Because fundamentally, you have to be betting on an entrepreneur and his or her vision for what they want to do. You're not going to bet on what you would do if you were in their shoes. So, I found that I had to really condition and coach myself to listen to what the entrepreneur planned to do. And sure, you could give input and you could give feedback, and maybe you could end up, impacting the course, the course of the strategy that they choose to pursue. But fundamentally, you have to believe in the business as being executed by the founder, not the business that you would execute if you were the founder.
I asked, our mutual friend and longtime first round, partner, Kent Goldman, what's the question he would ask you? And he said, if you were starting a firm today, a seed fund today, how would you compete with first round?
I chose to start first round because I thought at the time that we chose to start it, there was a real gap or a hole in the market focused on seed stage. Today, by all intents and purposes, that gap has been more than filled by first round and by the hundreds of other great micro VCs that have come in. If I was starting a venture firm today, I wouldn't start a micro venture firm. I wouldn't start a seed stage firm.
What would you start?
If I were starting a firm today, I would sit down and say, where is the gap in the market? So on the one hand, I think there actually is a gap in Series A funding, in that you've seen a 4x increase in the number of companies that are seed funded, but you haven't seen any increase in the number of companies that are A funded, so A, that are raising A rounds. So I actually believe there's a gap there, that if you look at sort of what's being the most overlooked, it's A round funding. And then the other thing I'd look at is say, where is venture have a hard time playing? So like one area where venture has a hard time playing right now is might be spaces where progress takes more than 24 or 36 months. So, right, like if you look at the typical venture firm, they have to, you know, they lead an A round and then they need a B round in 18 months, which means a company needs to, you know, execute and hit milestones in 18 months. And in certain industries and for certain types of companies, that's great. But there are also other types of companies and other types of sort of true hard science where I'd say venture might not be winning because of its structural challenges.
So the short answer to Kent is you couldn't compete on the seed stage, but to look for other opportunities.
And it's not just with First Round. It's with the hundreds of other firms, right? Like the hard part is I believe that it's important to offer a differentiated product. Our entrepreneurs are our customers, and we offer a product. The product is the set of community services, tools that we offer them that to hopefully help them win, to help them help their company succeed. And it gets really hard to offer a differentiated product when capital has become a commodity. I mean, Naval, an angelist, has spoken a bunch about the unbundling of venture, and I think we're seeing that.
But when do you get into the A world, then you get into Greylock and Sequoia and Benchmark. So how do you really compete there?
So I think what you're seeing now is that the companies that are going out for the A round, just because there's so many more seed-funded companies, the bar that a company needs to clear to raise an A round is much higher than it has ever been before. And that's really because the venture firms have far more choice. They could be more selective. When you see a 4x increase in the number of candidates, that's massive, right? Like if I was running a college admissions and I had, from one year to the next, a 4x increase in the number of candidates, yet my dorms are the same, I have the same number of students and seats in the classroom, I have the same number of faculty, one could argue that you could compose multiple freshman classes that have the same SAT test score. And I would argue the same thing happens with startups, that you're seeing far more companies get seed funded. And I would argue that you should be seeing an increase in Series A companies, which means that some great companies are not getting funded just because the Series A firms are able to look for traction, you know. So I'd say they've gotten less venturesome.
Makes sense. What do you think is your core competence as an investor? What are you best at? Either one skill or a combination of skills?
Well, one of the things I'm most proud of, by the way, is not my ability to pick companies, but instead my ability to pick partners. You know, I when I look at the partners that have been fortunate enough to work with at First Round, I'm really proud of the team that we've built, and I'm proud of the companies that those partners have picked. So that's the first sort of core skill set that I'll take some credit for. But in terms of what does a venture capitalist, what skill set do they need to make a difference? I think there's something that comes from empathy, from understanding the world that an entrepreneur faces, understanding the perpetual uncertainty, understanding the loneliness, understanding the fact that a founder is hearing one thing from customers, which could be different than competitors, which can be different than the media, which could be different than investors, which could be different than employees. And that founder's job is to sort of take all these differing point of views and come up with the right answer. And that's really hard. And I think that it's really important that when you're working with founders or you're sitting in the metaphorical boardroom or you're an investor in companies, that you recognize the challenge, how hard it is to be a founder, how hard it is to know what the right thing to do is. And so I've tried as an investor to avoid being overly prescriptive or overly hands-on. I clearly might share a point of view, you know, but I tell my founders that I work with, that I owe them two things. I feel like I owe them my candid, unvarnished opinion, and I also owe them my support. As a seed stage firm, we back entrepreneurs, and so fundamentally, we have to recognize that they're driving the bus. We're just passengers. So while I'm happy to share, and I believe I have an obligation to share my point of view when I disagree with them, should they choose to go in the direction that they want to go, they have my complete support to do so.
Why do you think you're a good picker of partners? You know, what do you, you know, some of them you've started from day one, like Howard, some of them you've risen through the ranks, like Finn. What are you looking for in a potential partner, and how do you evaluate them?
What I'm looking for are people who are inherently curious. I'm looking for people who have diverse and divergent points of view. I don't believe that unanimity is required to make an investment. And I look for people who enjoy the craziness that comes with entrepreneurship, right? You, to be a founder and to think that you're going to sort of change the world and you're going to overcome the inertia and the gravitational pull of the status quo, you have to be a little bit crazy. And I look for partners who are drawn to that. I look for partners who are a good judge of people, of talent. I look for partners who really value integrity. I look for partners who are good people, who I, you know, the amount of time that we spend together is so, it's massive. So you don't want to spend your time with assholes. And I look for partners that understand the value of community and sort of have signed off on the mission of First Round to be their mission as well.
Yeah. So much on the seed stage is the entrepreneur that you're picking. First off, how much is it entrepreneur versus idea and, you know, and market? And second, when you're just evaluating the entrepreneur, you know, are there telltale signs of things you've learned to look for or to not look for? How do you evaluate on that side?
So I think for us, it's almost all entrepreneur, but I'd argue that there are some really effective lenses to that we use to look at an entrepreneur. So, you know, you can meet with an entrepreneur once, twice, and most good entrepreneurs can give good meeting, right? You know, they're charismatic, they're persuasive. So what we try to do is look for ways to sort of get beyond that. So one example is, are we going to look at the product? Sure, we're going to look at the product. We're not doing so because we expect that their current prototype is going to be anything near what it looks like when it touches a customer. But instead, when you actually look at what a product is a physical instantiation of dozens, if not hundreds, of decisions that founder has made over the past. So like a product is a DVR for decisions that the founder has made. And the ability to look at that product as a lens as to why the founders made certain decisions and why they didn't is really impactful. So we're not looking at the product because we believe that this is, you know, we want to determine whether this is customer ready. We're looking at the product because it's a really good way for us to understand how that founder or how those founders have made decisions in the past. Does that make any sense?
Yep, absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. How can an investor be most helpful to the entrepreneur? Is it with advice and support and mentorship? Is it with, you know, helping hire? Is it helping get customers?
So when we ask that question to our companies, we hear relatively consistent things. And it's pretty much four things. Help us hire. Help us get some initial customers. Help us raise our next round. And help us find the right resources to solve specific problems. They don't need generalist advisors. If you have an e-commerce company that's looking to negotiate a deal with FedEx and UPS, they need the right person who's done that multiple times before. So those are the four areas that we routinely hear from our founders that they're asking for the most help.
And the resource, the right time. You know, one of the things you guys launched last year was sort of something to help with advisors. Do you have another initiative upcoming or something in the startup ecosystem that isn't yet figured out that First Round could take a stab at it?
Yeah, so we've been working over the last several, almost for the last year, on this advisory concept, specifically because I think startup advisors are broken. What tends to happen is a startup, you know, picks three or four generalists, calls them their advisory board, gives them some shares, and maybe in the first 3 or 4 months, the founder gets some strong advice and feedback from them. But typically, the level of engagement drops off very precipitously after that. And so our approach has been, rather than trying to sort of find an advisory board who could sort of provide general advice, what if companies could get connected to the right practitioner for the problems that they're, you know, look, if you know startup founders, the problems that they're trying to answer, or, you know, the problems or questions or challenges they're trying to overcome in January are very different than those they'll experience in February and very different than those they'll experience in March. There's constantly new things that companies need to do. So what if you could assemble a pool of experts who are able and willing to provide advice, consult, help solve specific tactical problems that a company has? Whether that is, you know, how do I put together a sales comp plan, or what should my interviewing, you know, what should the sort of interview rubric be for product managers, or I have real challenges around SEO, or what do I need, what copy do I need to put on my, for my app in the App Store to increase downloads? Like, there are real challenges that companies have all the time that instead of someone being an advisor for 2 years, you really need someone to provide you with tactical advice over the next 2 days. And that's what we've been working to assemble now as we've been building out our expert network internally. It's this collection of people and resources who could provide real specific actionable engagement and actionable advice as needed by our companies.
What I've been blown away by first round is the strength of the platform team and even the people who aren't the main partners. We've done a few events with you guys, and it's just been incredible. I mean, you guys are really an army. And so my question is, one, how are you finding these people? Two, how are you motivating them to work as hard as you guys do? And three, you know, I know that they're not leaving because I've asked them. How are you motivating them to stay?
So I think we have a really special culture at First Round, and a lot of it comes from the importance that platform has for us, right? Platform is not an add-on. Our community is not sort of just another feature. It's very core to what we do. So the first thing is, I think people like working for companies when they really have the ability to make an impact and touch their customer, and in some cases make an impact in the market. And I think that we've been fortunate that to attract an incredibly talented team on our platform, our community, our services team. We have some amazing recruiters. We have people that are focused on, you know, on events. We have people that are focused. We have product managers and engineers. Like, and all of those folks have choices. And I think they're here because they believe that they're making an impact, both in terms of, you know, the fun, but there are also secondary ways that we make an impact. Almost 80% of our limited partner dollars are from foundations and nonprofits. So when we succeed and make and generate, you know, when we have companies that succeed and generate a return for our investments, we're not only hopefully impacting the world by the great changes that our companies cause, but we're also hopefully impacting the world because we're creating wealth for nonprofits that are going to go on and have a meaningful benefit as well. So I think there are multiple ways that we try to sort of reinforce the mission.
And you also have a nonprofit, right?
Personally, yes.
Tell us a story about how you created that and how that's evolved over the decade plus that's been alive.
When we sold Half.com, I was fortunate enough to have a good outcome. And my philanthropy had always been important for my wife and I, so we decided to set up a small foundation. Some of the best advice I was given was by a friend who says, just like with angel investing, you're going to make a lot of mistakes up front, so start off writing smaller checks. I'm very thankful I got that advice because same thing with philanthropy, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. But the focus has really evolved to the fact that when you look at someone who's starting a traditional for-profit business, there's an entire ecosystem of content, advisors, investors, angels, people who are there from the very beginning, whether it's the, you know, the Y Combinators of the world or angelists. Like, there are unbelievable amounts of tools and resources, Product Hunt, like, to help founders from day one all the way through the investment banks to take them public. Yet if you look at a nonprofit founder, a social entrepreneur, you know, I think what we found, and to some degree, you know, while there have been a lot of people focusing on it and it's gotten better, it's still a problem, is that there are far less resources available at the earliest of stages. Most of the existing philanthropies, for example, don't fund companies before they've created their 501c3. So it becomes really hard for that social entrepreneur to get access to capital or advice at the same quality and same level that maybe a for-profit entrepreneur can. So that's kind of been where one of the big areas of focus for me philanthropically.
And when you look at first round, you know, when you look at the future of first round and how it's going to evolve and what you see for it, let's say, what does first round look like in 2020?
So, you know, I hope that in 2020 we're still putting out holiday videos. You know, if we ever get too, you know, if our heads ever get too large that we stop doing it, that would concern me. You know, one of the things that we've tried to do at First Round is continue to think about venture capital. You know, like think of our firm like a startup. We have customers, we have shareholders, we have competitors. You know, we have to focus on sales and marketing. And the way that we've tried to do it is to continue to innovate. So whether it's things like our online network or whether it's things like the First Round review, you know, I think we're continuing to experiment, and every year we're launching 2 to 3 experiments. Some of those fail, but some of those also become really meaningful parts of First Round going forward. So if you looked at First Round 4 years ago, it was a different firm than it is today, and I'd expect that 4 years from now, it will be different. I don't think that our stage will change. I don't think that we're going to be late stage investors. I don't think any meaningful changes along in terms of strategy. But in terms of the tactics and our approach, I think that we're continuing to experiment, and I hope that the firm is dynamic and looks different. I think that's also one of the things that attracts people about being part of First Round, is that they know that we're not complacent. They know that we're trying to continue to reinvent ourselves.
And do you see yourself as a competitor to YC at all?
Well, I don't know. I'd say that we funded a fair amount. I think we funded over 20 Y Combinator companies. To the extent that we aspire to meet with entrepreneurs as early as possible, you know, and want to be the first source of institutional capital. You know, would I love to get 7% of the company for 150 grand? Sure. But I also think YC provides great value for entrepreneurs.
Right. And, you know, YC launched a, growth fund, researched like kind of nonprofit. They have an accelerator. You don't necessarily see First Round doing any of those big kind of institutional initiatives, more in the current framework of what you guys have and is working.
Yeah. I think that there are many ways to run a firm, right? So the last thing I've been very impressed by how Y Combinator has grown and built their brand and over the years, and I think they've done an amazing job. So there are many ways to build a firm, and what works for them, and clearly it's working for them, might not work for us. And our approach has been that, you know, I think our true north is that we're a seed stage firm, that we're an early stage firm, that we think the first 18 to 24 months of a startup's life are a magical time, and that's where we want to spend our time. So while we've had opportunities to structurally expand, historically we've said no to them because we wanted to stay focused on our true initial mission.
And for you personally, are there other personal goals that you have, you know, of things you'd want to start or see in the world that you haven't yet done?
Personally, I just get a lot of satisfaction out of working at First Run and helping entrepreneurs at this stage. So I can't see myself doing anything else. That said, venture is a young person's business. So, you know, I think that every venture capitalist has sort of an expiration date. And I really admire, for example, Benchmark, who's built a firm with a culture of sort of just, you know, self-obsolescence, of recognizing that beyond a certain age, you know, they need to sort of bring new partners and new blood in.
Mm-hmm. I'll close the hard question. What's something you used to believe about investing, you know, fervently believe about investing, that you now see is fundamentally misguided?
I think I used to underestimate the role of luck in the early stage. I think that history is written by the winners, and winners tend to therefore ascribe skill to their success. But I think many people have to work very hard to get very lucky to be good investors. And at the stage that, you know, even the best pickers in the world, at the stage that we're investing, at the very, you know, when you're funding keynotes and PowerPoints, not products and revenues, I think there's an incredible amount of luck there. I mean, look, I'd say there's skill as well, but I think that people tend to underestimate the role that luck plays. And that's been something that over the last decade I've come to appreciate, which is as good as I think I am and as good as I think my partners in the fund are, I recognize that, you know, pretty much we bust our ass to try to get lucky.
Yeah. And are there comparisons to poker, legitimate?
In what way?
That it's a lot of luck, but the best people still win.
I'm not sure I could argue that the best people still win. I think that without hard work and without being smart, it's much harder to get lucky, but it's not impossible.
Right. Josh, has been a fantastic interview. You know, our listeners who are entrepreneurs and investors will take a lot from it. Are there any, things you want to plug for First Round to our audience? You know, where can they learn more about you and you guys online or anything you have upcoming?
Sure. You know, our goal, well, I guess what I could say is the following, is that we aspire to be every entrepreneur's first call. First call when they need funding, first call when they need help or advice. They can learn more about us at firstround.com, follow at firstround on Twitter, or me, follow at Josh K on Twitter. And if there's any mistake that founders make, more often than not, it's that they wait too long before contacting us rather than contacting us too early. We're in the business of meeting with founders who have ideas at the earliest stage. So I'd encourage people to reach out to us as early as possible rather than waiting. Oftentimes, yet founders believe that they need to have more than they actually do need to have in order to generate interest from us or other investors.
Your inbox is about to get flooded.
I welcome it.
Excellent. Josh, thank you for taking the time. This has been fantastic. Huge fan of what First Round has done. And, you know, it's funny, we're not a portfolio company, but Rob and Camille have told us that we feel like a portfolio company to you guys.
You do. It's been amazing watching you guys execute and watching you guys grow. And it's kudos to you guys for everything you've built.
Absolutely. Thank you, Josh.
Take care.